The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I often feel very undeserving for some of the things she says, but it's great to have you as a friend, and thank you. And it's wonderful to be here. Thank you, this amazing library. It's what an incredible experience. Thank you, Andrew, for making this happen and all the other phenomenal programs here. And I'm just thrilled to see so many of you on this blustery gale night, you know, come out to something like this. I think I would have stayed in and watched reruns of last night's part of the World Series. And I just want to say, you know, being from New England, I lived in Boston for 15 years, but I grew up in New Hampshire. The Red Sox were everything to us, you know. And we had to wait. You know, they won the World Series in 1918. And we waited and waited, and every year everybody went out and supported them and supported them. And, I mean, you guys haven't had to wait all that long. You know, 1980 isn't that long ago. And these two great cities, you know, the real birthplaces of this country, of democracy, Boston and Philadelphia. And as I said, I'm from Boston. I'll say no more. And I did want to point out that last year, on the first game of the World Series, the night, Lynn and I had the extreme good fortune of speaking together in Boston on the first night of the World Series played in Boston to the Red Sox. You think that's fun? But the Red Sox went on to win. So since we're here together in Philadelphia on this night, there's no doubt about what's going to happen tomorrow. Yes. Go Phillies! So we're in a revolution. We are truly in a revolution right now. I think this time in history is equivalent roughly to the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, the time when city-states became nations. We're in the throes of an incredible revolution today. And we see this all around us. You know, as Lynn mentioned, and as we all know, the systems are all collapsing. But for the first time in the history of this planet, every single human being, every single life form on this planet is being faced by the same crises. Before, we might have had hurricanes in Florida and gales up here in Philadelphia and tsunamis in Indonesia, but they didn't really impact everybody and anybody else so much. But today, every single life form on this planet is being impacted by climate change, by diminishing resources, by overpopulation, by extreme violence that comes out of desperation. More than half the people on this planet are hungry. Every life form is facing economic crisis and tremendous pressures that are building and building and building. This is a first in history. And for the first time in history, we're all communicating with each other through the cell phone and the internet. We all know this is happening. And so this creates an amazing opportunity. We are in the throes of a revolution. I believe that we are in the process of leaving behind what I call the adolescent stage of human development. And that is a stage when we said, I can only gain by exploiting someone else. My country can only gain by exploiting another country. It's an adolescent colonialistic view of the world. And we are now entering a time when we must move into a mature recognition that we are a very fragile species living on a very tiny planet. For the first time in history, it is a tiny planet. The planet hasn't changed in size, but we have, and our technology have. And I think this crisis that we're going through is one that was prophesized by many indigenous cultures around the world. It's time for this to happen. Less than 5% of the world's population live here in the United States. We consume more than 25% of the resources. That is a failed system. It is not a model that we could ever have passed on to China or India or Latin America or Africa or even continue with ourselves. And so it's time that it went its way and we move into something else, something more important. I'm very, very optimistic, or I should say I have great hope. I'm not just a generally an optimistic person, but I have great hope that we, you and I together, will move into this. And so why I'm here tonight, and what I'd like you all to make a commitment to join me in, is that when we leave here tonight, every one of us, we will all be committed individually and as a group to move forward to create a sustainable, just, spiritually fulfilling, and peaceful world, that we will all move forward into that. I have my daughter, who's 26, just a year ago, gave me a grandson. And when I hold this little baby in my arms and look down at him, I think, you know, what is this world going to be like 6 decades from now when he's my age? And, of course, if we stay the course, it's going to be pretty ugly. But we have an opportunity to do something remarkable, to create something amazing, something never done before in human history. And I'm going to talk about that tonight, and I'm also going to tell some stories about economic hitmen and where all this comes from, and jackals and the others. But I want to start. People always have advised me, you know, John, you ought to start your talks with telling a joke. Well, I've tried that, and it doesn't work. Because I'm not very good at telling jokes. I can't even remember them. But I want to start with a story that's funny, I think. It's a personal story. It's a true story. It's a little bit about my first experience working for the U.S. government. And feel free to laugh. It's supposed to be funny. So when I got out of business school in Boston, I joined the Peace Corps. And the Peace Corps sent me to the Amazon. But before that, they sent me to training camp in Southern California where I spent 8 weeks learning Spanish, which if you speak another language, you know 8 weeks ain't a hell of a lot of time, and also learning about credit and savings co-ops. And then they sent me to Ecuador, to Quito. And after that, I took a two-day bus ride in this rickety old wooden bus over the Andes for 2 days, this rickety old wooden bus filled with goats and chickens and pigs and people. And everything on that bus was vomiting for those whole 2 days, especially me. And I'm getting very homesick and wishing I had gone to Vietnam instead. But anyway, we get to the end of the road. The rainforest, we're now in the rainforest. I've got a two-day walk into the place where I'm supposed to spend the next 2 years. And as I'm walking into the rainforest, there's people walking out. And I'm thinking, this is a good opportunity for me to practice my lousy Spanish. To my chagrin, I discovered that the people walking out don't speak Spanish. They speak Shuar. I'm going out to work with the Shuar people. How many people here have seen a shrunken head or a picture of one? Oh, okay, well, the Shuar did it. They're about the only people on earth that do. This is who I'm going to spend the next 2 years with, and they don't speak Spanish. So my first, you know, experience with the U.S. government was, teach me a language, send me to a place nobody speaks any language. I get there. There are a few Quechua people. There's a few people that speak Spanish, including the school teacher. He comes out and welcomes me, and I say, yes, I'm here to help you guys form your credit and savings co-op. You got it. You know, it's my bananas for your papayas. There's no money in this area. And he says, oh, I don't know. He says, we asked for an agricultural co-op specialist. But, you know, I was raised in 300 years of Yankee Calvinists in New Hampshire and Vermont. We Calvinists are the original Puritans, you know, the Congregationalists. And if there's one thing a Calvinist has ground into him from the day he's born, it's when you're sent into a job, by God, you do it. Peace Corps sent me in with a backpack filled with comic books in color, in Spanish, about how to form credit and savings co-ops. So I hand out these comic books every day, religiously. And then every night I got up in front of the community and I gave a speech in my terrible Spanish about credit and savings co-ops. Well, a funny thing happened. More and more people came every night to hear me talk. And I'm like, thank you, Mom and Dad. Calvinism works. I just noticed we got a star on the ceiling here. That's pretty nice. Calvinism works, you know. But the school teacher came by at one point, and he says to me, look, he says, Have you looked around and noticed that there aren't any televisions here? There aren't any radios? There's no electricity. There aren't any magazines? Nobody could read. He says, you're it. Saturday Night Live. Every night. The jungle drums had beat their rhythm, you know. There's this tall, gangly gringo in our midst. He can't shoot a blowgun. He doesn't know how to track animals. He doesn't know how to live in this rainforest. And he's crazy. He gets up every night and blithers away in a foreign language about something that... And, you know, he's not going to live very much longer, so you better come see him. So about this point, I get the message, you know, like my vaunted education has nothing to teach these people. But they had a hell of a lot to teach me, a lot. And mainly it was about relationship, you know, about how we relate to the plants and the animals and the rocks and the rivers, not just to other human beings, but to everything. And how to receive messages. If a plant's dying, what does it mean? What are we doing wrong? Take on that responsibility. And then I got very, very sick. I lost about 35, 40 pounds in a week. I was dying. No question, I was dying. The nearest Peace Corps doctor, the nearest MD doctor, is 2 days hike through the jungle, 2 days on that awful bus with vomiting people. I couldn't do it. So at some point, the teacher comes back up to me, and he's leading this old man by the hand, and he brings the old man up to me, and he says, this guy's a shaman. And I'm like, well, I'm from New Hampshire. What's a shaman? He can heal you. Now the old man steps back and he looks me from toe to head, up and down, and he steps forward and he says, you're dying. And that's good, he says, because he believed in reincarnation. And he figured my life at this point was just about as bad as it could possibly get. It's time to move on to the next one. And I started crying, I think. And he says, oh, my God, maybe you're not ready to die. In which case, I can heal you tonight. So he did. And what happened that night was pretty amazing because I couldn't talk to him. He sang to me. He did chants and we did the ceremony. But what happened that night was that during that night, I saw that my parents had brought me up in New England with this concept that you had to eat meat and potatoes, no onions, no spices. You had to be really careful. You couldn't get your feet wet in the winter. Imagine living in New Hampshire not getting your feet wet in the winter. And all these concepts. Now, the schwa, their most important food is something called chicha. It's a kind of beer that's made by women chewing and spitting the manioc root, and then you drink it, you know. And we used to eat things, reach in the tree and pull out live grubs, and you eat them very full of protein. There's all these different foods and strange foods, and I had to eat them. There was nothing else to eat, but every time I ate them, there's my mom saying, it'll kill you. And that night I saw that the schwa were extremely healthy. The men are all built like Rambo, you know, and the women are incredibly sexy and gorgeous, and many of the people live to be very old, and so I'm saying there's something wrong. I've got the wrong dream, the wrong paradigm, the wrong mindset. Something's wrong here. My parents, what's wrong? These people are eating the same food. They're healthy. And that night, it changed my dream, my mindset. And the next day, I was healthy. And from then on in, Peace Corps assignment was for 2 years. I extended a third year, fell in love with these people. I go back all the time now. I've got children, godchildren amongst them. And we've been now working with the Achwa, the next tribe over, who incidentally, when I was no white man had ever seen an Achwa in 1968 to 71, when I was there, Achwa had made no contact with the outside world. I used to tell my Schwa friends, I want to be the first white man to meet an Achwa. And they said, no, you don't. 75, the Achwa made contact, and now we've got this amazing partnership with them. One reason I told that story is because we now are at a state on this planet where we have sick societies. We're ill. And I think all it's going to take is a mindset, a new dream, to turn that around. And that's very indigenous thinking, too. I'm going to talk about that in just a few minutes, this what we do to turn that mindset around. But first, I'd like to share with you a little bit about what an economic hitman is, for those of you who haven't read the book. I think we economic hitmen, it's fair to say, we've created the world's first truly global empire in history. And we've done it for the first time primarily without the military. We work many ways, but the most common is that we will identify a third world country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil, and then arrange a huge loan to that country through the World Bank or one of its sisters. But the money never actually goes to the country. Instead, it goes to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in that country, power plants, industrial parks, highways, things that benefit a few rich families as well as our corporations, but don't help the majority of the people at all. They're too poor to buy electricity. They don't have the skills to get jobs in industrial parks. They don't own cars for the highways. And yet the whole country, is left holding this huge debt. It's such a big debt, they can't possibly repay it. So at some point, we go back to them and say, listen, you can't pay your debt, so give us a pound of flesh. Sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies. Vote with us on the next critical UN vote. Send troops in support of ours to someplace in the world, like Iraq. And in that way, we've really created this empire. On the few occasions when we fail, and I talk in my books about how I failed with Jaime Roldós, president of Ecuador, and Omar Torrijos of Panama, I could not corrupt these men. I could not bring them around. They refused to be corrupted. They refused to be bought. And when that happens, then the jackals go in. And these are people who overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. And because I have failed with Jaime Roldós and Omar Torrijos, both of them were assassinated. And we all know about Allende and Arbenz and Lumumba and Diem and so many others, Mossadegh. There's many that we've done this with. On the few occasions when the jackals fail, then and only then the military goes in. That's what happened in Iraq. And that's another story, maybe in the questions and answers that will come up. But we both failed twice in Iraq in the late 80s. And the military went in 91. And after that, we assumed that Saddam Hussein had been sufficiently chastised when we took out his military that he would come around. We didn't want to take him out. He's the kind of leader we like, a strong man who can control his people, keep the oil flowing. We thought we could bring him around after taking out his military in 91, but we couldn't. He resisted again. And he had very good security. He had a lot of lookalike doubles. It's hard to assassinate a man that has that kind of knowledge. And so, once again, we sent the military in. So these are the three stages: economic hitmen, jackals, military. And I think the really, aside from the fact that this is a pretty disgusting system, it's also a very secretive one. We are the first empire, and we are an empire, make no bones about it. 5% of the world's population consuming more than 25% of its resources, spreading its language around. There's many different factors. I define empire 8 different points in secret history, and we satisfy every one of those points. You actually need to satisfy 2 to be an empire. But every other empire has built itself with its military, with pride. The British, the Spanish, the Portuguese, the Dutch, the Romans, the Greeks, the Persians, on and on. They went out to colonize the world, to create civilization, to spread Christianity, whatever it was. And they sent their young men out to conquer other lands, and everybody knew they were doing it. But we've built this empire through subterfuge. And most people living here in the United States don't realize that this has been going on, that these economic hitmen and jackals have been out there. Therefore, we have to really question our role as a democracy. You know, we've got an election coming up, and we're worried about stolen elections, and we should be. But we also need to worry about something deeper. And that is this basic question, that if a democracy is based on the assumption that it has an informed electorate, and that is the assumption, and if the electorate doesn't know about this most important aspect of our foreign policy, can we really be a democracy? And that's one of the reasons I wrote the books, because we need to understand what's going on out there. Today, there truly is a revolution. You're here. You know, as my confessions was on the economic, it was on the New York Times bestseller list for over 70 weeks. It's all over the world. And amazing to me, I'm being invited to speak at huge conferences of corporate CEOs. In a couple of weeks, I'm speaking here at Wharton with the CEO and chairman of the board of Coca-Cola, and I are both speaking together on the same stage. I mean, that's pretty. Why? Because there is a revolution going on. And some of the executives at the top of some of these organizations truly understand this. Part of that revolution is really, really manifest in Latin America. 9 countries in Latin America representing more than 80% of the population of South America in the last elections have voted in the president who said, no more exploitation by foreign corporations. Ecuador's oil ought to profit Ecuador's people, poor people. Bolivia's gas ought to profit Bolivia's poor people. 9 countries. And during most of my lifetime, every one of those countries was run by a brutal dictator under the thumb of Washington until now. Something amazing has happened in South America in the last few years, and every one of those has come about through democracy and peacefully. It's an incredible revolution. 2 of those presidents, Chile and Argentina, are women. And they bring deep women values in. And this is very important. If we're going to move into a new paradigm, a new mind shift, we can't just do it using the old patriarchal approach, the paternalistic approach, the male approach. We've got to bring that feminine receptivity and nurturing ability into this. And Bachelet and Kirchner of Chile and Argentina, respectively, are women who do this. It's very important. And the other presidents, the men, are all bringing tremendous numbers of women into their cabinets. They've all committed to at least 50% women and are doing it. And Lynn in Pachamama Alliance is working very hard, her husband Bill, all of us with Pachamama Alliance, with Rafael Correa, this president of Ecuador, who has a PhD in economics from the University of Indiana, incidentally, or is it Illinois? Anyway, He's not a radical socialist communist. He comes from a background that really honored the indigenous, a poor background in Ecuador, but he also was trained as a capitalist. And he's introduced this new constitution, which Pachamama Alliance was deeply involved, that for the first time in history, a country has now voted in by 70% of the vote just a couple of weeks ago, a new constitution that gives nature rights, that says plants, animals, rivers, lakes have rights, inalienable rights, first time in history. And it's a watershed. Many other countries now are looking at this. A true revolution is happening. But I want to tell you, I spent last New Year's Eve with Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia. I've met with the Correa people a number of times, and Daniel Ortega and his people in Nicaragua, and several of these other presidents. And every one of them will tell you that shortly after they were elected, someone who looked like me, I don't think I'm real sinister looking, someone who spoke Spanish and had been in the presidential palace many times, familiar face, walked into that president's office and said, congratulations, Mr. President or Ms. President. And now I just want to remind you that in this pocket over here, I've got a couple of $100 million for you and your family if you play our game. And in this pocket over here, well, I just got to be careful what you say. There may be tape recorders running. I just want to remind you of what happened to Arbenz in Guatemala and Mossadegh in Iran and Allende in Chile and Roldos and Torrijos and Diem and Lumumba and on and on. Every one of these presidents, these 9 presidents in Latin America, has come up against this. What would you do? What would you do if you were one of these presidents? You know it's very real, and you know that if you get taken out, the next guy is going to be in a very tough position. What would you do? Give that some thought. But I'll tell you what. Even better, it is up to us, because it's our country that's doing that. It's us. We have to take responsibility for this. We need to move forward and change this. And we need to ask ourselves, so how do we really change this? Where is the power base? And I think one of the first questions is, if this is an empire, then who's the emperor? An emperor is someone who's not elected, doesn't serve a limited term, and doesn't report to anyone. Well, obviously, our presidents aren't in that position, at least not, we haven't seen that yet. But we do have a group of people that is, and I call these people the corporatocracy. Incidentally, this is not a conspiracy theory. These people don't have to get together and conspire to do anything illegal. But these are the people that run our big corporations. And they really control our government. They've got 35,000 lobbyists in Washington, D.C. alone. Nobody gets elected in this country without a lot of money that somehow comes through the corporations. Or even if a president, like, let's say, Obama, does feel that he can be apart from that, he's still got to deal with a Congress that has all of that. And they control our mainstream media, either through direct ownership or through advertising budgets. They don't report to anybody. They're not elected. And they don't serve a limited term. They say they report to their boards of directors, but they all serve on each other's boards, and they basically rubber stamp each other. These are the modern equivalent of emperor. And when I mentioned the Obama thing, I didn't want to in any way discourage anyone. This is an incredibly important election, and there's no doubt about that. But we all need to understand that whoever our elected officials are, they're going to need our support throughout. We can't just finish the election next week and say, oh, my man won. I can sort of walk away from this, because they're going to be under tremendous pressure from the corporatocracy. And so it's this corporatocracy that is really calling the shots. Used to be that we could look at the world as a globe with 180-some-odd countries, of which a few were very powerful, the Soviet Union, the United States, a few others. But today the geopolitics has changed radically. This globe is still there with 180-some-odd countries, but today you might envision huge clouds drifting around it. These are the big corporations. They know no national boundaries. They don't follow any particular set of laws. They'll form partnerships with the Chinese, the Russians, the Israelis, and the Palestinians, and anybody that serves their interests. They are calling the shots. And the good news, oh, well, let me just say one other thing. They are all driven by one single goal. It's not a conspiracy, but they are driven by one single goal: to maximize profits regardless of the social and environmental costs. And we have encouraged them in that goal, you and I. We've asked for the cheapest goods possible, and we've asked for the highest rates of return on our stock. And they're just kind of following our orders. And so the really good news here is that for the first time in history, we have an empire that's not built on the military. It's built on you and me and our shopping habits and our perceptions and our lifestyles. And that's why this economic crisis is so timely and so important, because it's going to change all this. But we can also change it every day, every time we shop. You know, if nobody ever buys a sweater or a pair of shoes made in a sweatshop ever again, there will never be any more sweatshops. It's that simple. Or the current sweatshops will be turned into legitimate. I want to buy things from Indonesia and China, but I want to know that those workers are getting fair wages, health care, and retirement benefits. And if we insist on that, if you never again buy from Nike, and you write them an email and say, I'm not buying from you because you have sweatshops, and instead you buy from Patagonia and write them and say, I'm buying from you because you don't have sweatshops, Nike will turn around. I want nothing more than to wear the Nike swoosh everywhere I go and see it as a symbol of a company that has no sweatshops, that has taken a new stand. And that must be our driving goal, I believe, in turning this whole thing around, is to convince corporations to take on a new objective, a new goal. Go ahead and make profits, but only within the context of creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. Only within that context. And when we do this, things will change. Things will begin to happen and move. And we're seeing this in Latin America. These presidents in Latin America know that this is not about the U.S. government alone, that the U.S. government is basically a servant of the big corporations at this point in history. This is new. It's been very recent that this has happened, but it's happened. We are, like I said earlier, very much like when the city-states became nations. And a lot of people didn't know what was happening until it had already happened. But it was happening, and this is happening. And these presidents understand this. And so they're taking on the corporations. Biggest lawsuit in the history of the environmental movement is Ecuador has initiated against Chevron Texaco for destroying the Amazon. Between $12 and $16 billion. These countries are taking on the corporations. They realize this is not about the U.S. government. It certainly isn't about the U.S. people. It's not about our Constitution. Their constitutions often quote ours, government of, for, by the people. They love what we represent. So they are setting this new precedent, but we all can buy into it. And so I'd like to... That's the mindset change. It's like when I was in the Peace Corps and in the Amazon, and I'm sick. I'm truly physically sick. I'm losing tremendous amounts of weight. But one night, the dream change, the change of attitude, I saw something. I saw a different way of looking at myself and my relationship to food, and it changed everything. If we can just make this change where everything we move forward with is directed toward creating a sustainable... Can you imagine working toward creating a non-sustainable world? It's an oxymoron. It's absurd. But we've been doing it for centuries. A sustainable, just, and peaceful world. And one other thing I want to point out is, as I mentioned, in a couple of weeks I'm speaking at the Net Impact conference here at Wharton. 2,000 people are expected, and it's sold out now. A lot of them corporate executives, and I've been invited to these things increasingly, and it shocked me. You write a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and then the Secret History of the American Empire, and you don't expect to ever speak to a corporate executive again. But I'm being invited more and more and more, and I just did a conference in Panama for a bunch of CEOs of extractive corporations, mainly Canadian, that work in South America, and I said, why the hell do you want me speaking to you? You know, they said, because we know we can no longer get away with the plundering and raping. They didn't use those words, but that we've been doing. We know that these new presidents are changing things, but we still want the bauxite, tin, copper, gas, and oil. So we want you to help us understand what we've got to do to be better citizens. I have known a lot of executives throughout my life, and I still do. I have never met one who wanted to see Florida sink beneath the ocean or the ozone layer destroyed. Never. There may be some. Maybe they worked for Enron. But I haven't met them. I meet executives who have children and grandchildren and they want a better world. But they're operating under this assumption that they got in business school, they've got growing up. You've given it to them. I've given it to them. We've all given it to them. Cheap goods and high rates of return. And to hell with what we do to the rest of the world. Basically, we've kind of said that. So we must change that. Just a little quick story. I'm going to move on quickly, and we're going to go to questions and answers in a minute. But a little story here that I think really highlights this. How many people here know Rainforest Action Network? Yeah, okay. And Rainforest Action Network works very closely with the Pachamama Alliance. And I don't want to talk too much about the Pachamama Alliance because I'm on its board and I helped to get it started, and that sort of sounds like my own whistleblowing. So I'll talk a little bit. I'm going to let some other people do that later. But Rainforest Action Network has turned around some of the most aggressive corporations in the world and got them to sign agreements to stop cutting rainforest and old-growth trees. They did this primarily with a staff of about 20 people and a budget of $2 million a year. And this includes Kinko's and Boise Cascade and Citicorp and Home Depot and many big corporations. A few years ago, they went after Mitsubishi, which at the time was the biggest, worst cutter of rainforest in the world. And the campaign got ugly. And they, particularly two individuals clashed, Randy Hayes, the founder of Rainforest Action Network, and a senior executive at Mitsubishi. That got really ugly between them. They locked horns. In the end, Rand won. They've never lost a campaign. And Mitsubishi signed the agreement. A few months later, I happened to be at a conference in Southern California with about 30 people, including these two individuals, Randy Hayes and the Mitsubishi executive. And, of course, they stayed as far apart from each other as they could. I remember on Saturday morning during the coffee break, the two of them headed for the coffee urn. I see them. I'm in the back of the room. I see them going toward the coffee urn. They see each other, and they poof. Saturday night, Randy and I decided to go up to a hot tub on top of the mountain. It was going to be a full moon, close to a full moon, out over the Pacific. And we decided to go up there, take a six-pack of beer, and exchange wild stories about the Amazon. So we head up there, and we get to the hot tub with our six-pack of beer, and there's already one person in it. The Mitsubishi executive has his six-pack of beer there, too. I don't think he wanted to do it, but he said, okay, well, come on in, guys. So we strip down, we get in the hot tub, you know, three guys naked, two six-packs of beer, hot tub, full moon over the Pacific, and I'm nervous. Two of these guys have been arch enemies. They've been ready to kill each other, and I'm the only thing between them. What the heck's going to happen, you know? Well, what happened was fascinating. At some point along the line, the Mitsubishi executive raises his beer can and he says, Randy, I want to toast you. I want to thank you. I got kids. I want to take them to the Amazon. A lot of other executives at Mitsubishi have kids. We wanted to do the right thing, but we didn't dare. We're afraid we'd lose our jobs until you and your people brought it to the attention of our executives, our board of directors, our stockholders, that we had to do something differently, and then we could go in and do the right thing. And I submit to you that there's executives all over this country, all over the world, in that same position, and it's up to us to get them to change that dream, to do the right thing. So what can you do, each of you? You know, in Confessions of an Economic Hitman and the Secret History of the American Empire, there's long lists of things that we can do and should do. You know, don't buy things made in sweatshops. You know, be careful of, you know, buy. We all know these things. The right way to drink water. So let me show you the right way to drink water. Watch carefully. Wow, your Philadelphia water is really good. No wonder those Phillies are doing so good. The Red Sox don't get such good water. That's a nice bouquet. The right way to drink water is obviously not from a bottle. Not Fijian water or Alpine water from, you know, from Austria, but water from your tap. And maybe you have to filter it. Maybe you have to get your water company to do a better job. Fill your own bottles. But I gave this talk one time, and at the end, as I'm at the book signing table, this young man comes up to me and leans over the table and he says, thank you for saying that. I'm from Fiji. We don't have water. We can't get Fijian water in Fiji. I got to come here to get it. You guys are stealing it all. So we all know there's many things. You know all these things. We must do these. We need to do these things. And beyond that, though, and, you know, follow your heart. You have passion. You have talents. I have a passion for writing. I hope I have some talents in it. So that's what I do. But you have your own passions and talents. Follow them. Follow your passions. Use your talents. Growing up in New Hampshire, I was a great student of the American Revolution. I had ancestors that fought in it. And I remember becoming so impressed with the fact that Tom Paine did not try to lead armies. And George Washington did not try to write pamphlets. Thank God. You know, Paine had a passion and a talent for writing pamphlets, and Washington for leading men. And Martha Paine had a passion and talent for bringing women together to make clothes for the men at the front and to get children to make bullets. And all of these people, they each followed their own path, but they were headed toward one destination. And our destination is a sustainable, just, spiritual, peaceful world. And if we all follow our passions and use our talents to get to that world, we will get there. And an important part of this process, I mentioned Rainforest Action Network, is organizations that put pressure on corporations, because we've got to change these corporations. That's essential in this process. You know, no matter, and this next election is extremely important for many, many reasons, including a very symbolic one. You know, the world is watching very, very carefully. Are we going to go the same old path we've been or take a new path? But we must be careful that we can't expect a president to turn everything around. We have to do it. This is a democracy. We want to keep it that way. We must do it. And joining organizations, ones that draw to your passion, is very important. And, you know, Lynn, who spoke earlier, is the heart and soul, or I don't know, she and her husband together are the heart and soul. They're both, I guess, behind Pachamama Alliance. How many people here are familiar with Pachamama Alliance? Fantastic. And they have this amazing program, Awakening the Dreamer. You can go to awakeningthedreamer.org to see where it's playing in your place. How many people here are facilitators for the symposium? Please stand up. Look at this. These are all teachers. Wow. All right. Thank you. I think we've now got 1,000 teachers in 17 countries or something. 20 countries. Every time I say it, I get it wrong because it keeps going up. And Chuck and Lee, would you stand up, please? You're kind of the organizers in these communities. So if you're... These are the organizers here. If you're interested in learning more, you can see them or any of the other people that stood up, or go to awakeningthedreamer.org or pachamama.org. But, you know, if your love, if your passion is animals, join an animal rights organization. If it's lost children, join a lost children's organization. If it's flowers, join a flower organization. Join. You know, give your energy in terms of time, work, or... Money is another form of energy. Lynn is the expert with her book, Soul of Money, her best-selling book, where she talks about money as being this energy. There's so much we all can do. But once again, I go back to the sense that, you know, follow your passion and use your talents. If you're in my generation, which is the 30 and older, I gather from your laughter that you think I'm younger than 30, right? If you're in my generation, you may be retired. And if you're retired, nobody can fire you. You've got nothing to lose by rattling that cage. Get out there and rattle it. You know, shake up the system. How much golf can you play? How much tennis? How much sailing? Get out there and shake it up. This is a revolution. Let's be part of it. Growing up in New Hampshire as a kid, I used to wish I'd been born in the 1700s so I could have been part of that revolution. And what I know now is this is a more important one. We are taking those principles that were never actually fulfilled even in this country, and now's the time we're going to fulfill them. Latin America is doing it today. We need to get on that bandwagon. We're about to do it in this next election and then move on with it on an individual basis. This is an incredible time in human history, and the collapse of the economic system is showing us a lot of that. You have incredible power. Every one of you has amazing power. As a young kid growing up in New Hampshire, I had no idea that African Americans had to ride on the back of a bus until Rosa Parks showed me. Who was Rosa Parks? A seamstress who sat on the front of a bus. How many people here have heard of Rosa Parks? You're Rosa Parks. You can sit on the front of a bus. It may take a little courage, but you can do it. And I had no idea growing up in New Hampshire that the DDT we were spraying on fish and we're spraying to kill on on the swamps to kill mosquitoes were also killing fish and birds until Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. How many people know Rachel Carson? And how many people here have heard of Mrs. Schneer? Mrs. Schneer? Huh. Mrs. Schneer was my third grade teacher. Had it not been for Mrs. Schneer, I wouldn't be here tonight. I wouldn't have written any of the books. I've got my books now sold several, I don't know, many millions of copies around the world in many languages. Mrs. Schneer's in every one of them. She taught me to stand up to a bully. That was one of the lessons. I grew up in this little town, Tilton, where we had a reform school in town. All the kids from there went to the public school. In third grade, there was a 15-year-old boy in my class. And he was mean. And he used to pick on me at recess. You know, he used to push me around a lot. And I'd go running to Mrs. Schneer. But she couldn't really do anything. They could throw him out of school for a week, but they had to let him back in because in New Hampshire we had a law. You had to be 16. You had to go to school until you were 16. So he kept coming back. And finally, one time I went to Mrs. Schneer and she said, "Johnny, you just got to stand up for yourself." And I'm like, "He's big." And she says, "Listen, next time he pushes you, just kick him in the shins and run like hell." I don't think she used the H word. So I did, and a funny thing happened. He cried, and he became my best friend and protector. And it was an amazing lesson. So Mrs. Schnee, I haven't ever heard from her since, but she's in every book I've ever written. She's here with us tonight. You're Mrs. Schneer. Every one of us has amazing impact. Every time we buy anything or decide not to, we are exercising our right to vote. The marketplace is perhaps the biggest democracy out there. We're not using it as that. But every time we buy something, we cast a vote. We decide which companies are going to make it and which ones are going to fail or which ones have to change. It's a true democracy if we just choose to use it as such. Every time you talk to someone next to you, you're having a huge impact. As you walk out of here tonight, you may end up talking with the next president of the United Nations or the United States or the next mayor of Philadelphia. Who knows? You have tremendous impact. Don't ever sell that short. And so I'm going to bring this to a close and move into some questions and answers and so forth. Hopefully there'll be some answers. But before I do, I just really, really want to leave you with this final thought, and that is that we are at an amazing time in human history today. We're seeing this collapse, and it's leading us into an opportunity to create a whole new system. Empires, history tells us that empires always collapse, and this one's in the throes of collapse. We really don't want it to collapse. We want to transform it. We want to turn it into a true model of government for of and by the people that the world can look at, a true model of equality, of justice, of sustainability, not of gluttony and materialism and exercising colonialistic control. We want to be the leaders in this new maturing process of moving into the next stage of what it is to be human. We can do that here. And I think it's going to start here tonight as the American Revolution started here in Philadelphia and Boston. And so as we leave here tonight, I'd like each of you to make a commitment to yourselves, and maybe voice it to a neighbor, voice it to someone as you're walking out, that we are committed to move forward, to recognize that my grandson and cannot possibly hope to inherit a sustainable, stable, peaceful, just, spiritual world unless every child growing up in Bolivia, Indonesia, Congo, Palestine, and Israel has that same expectation. We're a very small planet. Every child on this planet, and that includes every child of every species, must have that expectation, and it's up to you and I to make sure that's happened. And I really look forward to moving out into the world and doing that, all of us together. Thank you.
That's yours.
Thank you, John. Ladies and gentlemen, we have about 10, 15 minutes for questions. If you would raise your hand, please wait for the mic. I'll call on you, lady in the second row right here.
Along the lines of the Secret Empire, could you share some knowledge about the newly minted Amaro that has been minted at the Denver Mint to be used for Mexico, the United States, and Canada, and also maybe the related 10-lane highway that's being built from Mexico to Canada, and the new ID card for the use of North America?
I'd like to, but I don't think I know any more about it than you do. I don't like to speculate and talk about things unless I have personal experience, and I don't have personal experience in that, thank God. But it seems to me, from what I'm reading, which is, you know, you probably know more about it than I do, but from what I'm reading, it looks like something that's certainly happening, and it fits with all of the paradigms. You know, what's happening here in this country now is the economic hitmen are coming home to roost. So a lot of this financial crisis and the very scenario you're describing is so similar to what we've done all over the world in the past. And in a way, we all, and you know, I definitely include myself in this, we all have been a party to this. We've said, I want cheap goods from Indonesia or Philippines or wherever. You know, just bring them on. You know, I want to buy these things cheap, and I want a high rate of return. And now the markets have all shrunk, and the resources have shrunk. So it's come home to roost here. This whole credit crunch that's going on is so familiar to me. It's what we did in other countries. You know, exactly what's going on here now. And you can bet, as we go into this depression, that the corporatocracy is out there, and they're already doing it, and they're going to do it even more in the future. They're buying up all the best businesses, real estate, everything else. It's a fire sale for them. And so this is going on. We can stop it. And what you're describing, this bringing together of North America, of Mexico, of the United States, and Canada, is part of that process. I hope it doesn't go any further than this. I think it's up to us to stop it. I'd suggest it sounds like it's your passion. You have talents. Get in there and fight for it. You know, really, really get the word out. Get on the Internet is such an amazing vehicle now. You've got the free library here. You know, really get into that. Follow that passion and have fun with it. There's no greater joy in this world than to follow our passions and do something that creates a better world, not only for ourselves, but for future generations. And I'd really, really encourage you to do that. Thanks.
Another question. Lady in the magenta here, about five rows back.
Both from your time with Mr. Schneer and then afterwards in the jungle in Ecuador, how did you go from that realization that you could change your view of the world to then becoming lending yourself to being an economic hitman?
That's an excellent question. And the easy answer, the first step of that answer is I'd been to business school, and the business school model is the economic hitman model. It says that if you invest tremendous amounts of money in infrastructure in these countries, power plants, highways, industrial parks, you will increase the economy of the country. And in fact, you do. And so when I went into this business, I thought I was going to be doing good things. And I was trained by this woman, Claudine, who sort of told me what was going on. But as I say in my books, behind all that, I thought, I can change this. That's not going to happen to me. I'm above that. But there was this model. And, in fact, when we invested all this money in countries like Indonesia, their economies did boom. So the model worked. The problem was that what the models didn't show was that in that process, the rich got very, very rich and the poor got poorer. The gap spread. And it's more than doubled since I was an economic hitman, that gap between rich and poor. So from a macroeconomic standpoint, the models all worked. And I could look at those and say, this is working. And I was being patted on the back by Robert McNamara, president of the World Bank, personally. And I was being asked to speak at Harvard Business School and many other prestigious places about exactly what I was doing. I was doing nothing illegal. The jackals do illegal stuff, but what I did wasn't illegal. Should be, but it wasn't. And so for the first part of my career, I could really believe that I was doing the right thing. And over time, I began to understand that that wasn't right. And I think because I'd had the experience in Ecuador with the Schwa and later with the Quechua and with other people, I was in a position where I could really see they weren't benefiting. In fact, they were losing. So a big hydroelectric plant provides electricity to the very wealthy who run the big industries, And it stops up the rivers and destroyed a lot of land down the downriver for the Shuar and the other indigenous people. And I began to see that over time. And within 10 years, I could no longer tolerate what I was doing. And I write about this in Secret History, how at that point I had to get out. I did it for 10 years. I got out in 19. I made the decision to get out at the same time the Phillies won the last World Series. 1980, I left in about that time. But for a long time, I didn't get it. And then for a while, I was able to go into denial. I was living a very good life, making a lot of money, traveling around the world first class, going to places that I'd always wanted to visit, Iran, Indonesia, Egypt, all these places. And like so many of us, I think, and so many people now that are caught up in the system, it was easy for me to say, but I think it's the right thing. Everybody says it's the right thing. You know, everybody's patting me on the back, telling me I'm doing the right thing. So I guess I am. But over time, it took me a few more years, and then I realized, this is wrong. I got to get the hell out of here. And then in the 80s, I started writing the book that became Confessions, and I went out and talked to other economic hitmen and jackals to get their stories, and I was threatened. People came to me and threatened my life, threatened my daughter's life, who was born in 82, and they offered me bribes, big ones. They were legal bribes. They came in the form of paying me to use my resume as a consultant, but with the understanding I would not write the book. I talk about this extensively in Secret History. I took all this very seriously. I took the bribes, and I didn't do it. And then I wrote other books. I wrote 5 books about indigenous people, like Shapeshifting in the World is As You Dream It, but I stayed away from that. And then on 9/11, I was in the Amazon with the Shwa. I came home, and I flew to New York to Ground Zero. And as I stood there looking down into that smoke, it was still smoldering. You could still, it was awful. And as I stood there looking down, I knew I had to write this book, finally. I knew that the American people needed to be aware of why there's so much resentment in the world. And at this point, I decided I wouldn't tell anyone I was writing it. I wouldn't write a proposal. I'd write the whole manuscript all by myself. My wife and daughter wouldn't know what I was doing until I had it in the hands of my very good agent who had it, sent it out to publishing houses. At that point, it's my best insurance policy. Because any jackal out there knows that the worst thing that can happen is for me to be a martyr. So if one of you wants to stand up and shoot me right now, my publishers will probably be very happy. Because it'll sell a lot of books. Tomorrow, you know, if that happened tonight, and the jackals know this, tomorrow the book would hit the top of the New York Times bestseller list. There's no question about it. So... So it was a process, and I think it's a process that we can all relate to. You know, to a certain degree, we all do things that we know we shouldn't be doing, or we're not doing things we know we should be doing, and it's easy to justify. And I took it to a real extreme, and I have to live with that today. But the lesson there is that now I'm committed to spending the rest of my life, however long that is, to turning this around. Thanks for asking.
We are quickly running out of time, so we have a few more questions here. Gentleman in the purple on our right.
Thanks for calling on me. The Harvard Business School had some years ago brought forth to the public that corporations needed to begin to look at how they could sustain by having a sustainable planet. And I find it interesting that you were invited to speak at the Wharton School alongside with the CEO of Coca-Cola. And for me listening, it begs the question of really what is a sustainable world. And it seems as though there's a fine line between creating models that will have your company continue and flourish, and creating a world that works for everyone. And maybe you could address that a little.
Yeah, that's why I really think it's up to you and me and the rest of us to make that decision. I think we know what's sustainable, and you know. If you buy something made in a sweatshop, you're contributing to terrorism. You know, there's always going to be a few fanatical people like Osama bin Laden in the world. It looks like there will always be some serial killers and some messed up minds, but nobody will follow them unless they're desperate. And right now on this planet, we've got more than half the planet's living in desperation. And we know this. And we know that if we buy things that cheat people, not only are we hurting our own consciences, but we're creating a very difficult and unstable world. We know that if we're depleting resources and not recycling things in a real way and taking them back, that's not going to happen. We know now, we didn't know this when I was a kid, we thought you could throw anything into the ocean, you know, when you're sailing, anything, and cities could dump anything into the oceans and it all take care of it. We know that's not true anymore. We know that we can no longer keep sending carbon dioxide up into the atmosphere. We know that now. So it's up to us to make sure it doesn't happen anymore. It's up to us never to buy from companies that do that and to let them know. And buy from the ones that may not be perfect yet, but they're trying hard. And there's so many out there. I just came from speaking at the SNAP conference, which 400 entrepreneurs and executives, CEOs of companies like Whole Foods that are in the natural foods business or the organic foods or natural products business. They're not perfect by any means, but they're raising the bar constantly. They're pushing for this. We need to encourage that even when they're not perfect. And we've got the green festivals. You don't have one yet here, but there's... Oh, you do? You do? How come I haven't been invited to speak at that one? Okay, so Washington, Seattle, San Francisco, Chicago, and Philadelphia. What? Oh, it's a different green festival. Well, that's okay, too. I still want to be invited to that one. You know, at the Co-op America's one, we had 40,000 people in Chicago this last year, and this huge marketplace of all these people, we know, and it's up to us, because, yes, the executives are still under pressure to do, you know, to keep their companies profitable, but we must feel the pressure that we have to vote in the marketplace. So be really, really careful what you buy. You know, and it's not always the easiest thing in the world, but you can do it. You can figure out there's a lot of great websites now with that information. The Dream Change, I'm a founder of Dream Change. DreamChange.org has a long list on there. And there's a lot of websites in Secret History of the American Empire. There's a lot of information out there. But again, maybe this being your passion, you could further that, you know. You know, I've often, you know, and there are people working on this. Every product should have a barcode on it, and you could scan it and see everything about where everything that's in that product came from, and what the people making it are being paid, and what it's doing to nature in those places. That would be a great thing. Make that happen, please. Thanks.
Okay, lady in the black, be the final question over here.
Good evening. Nice to meet you. First of all, I want to thank you for being an inspiration for someone who would like to get into the healthcare business and try to change it, but every day gets discouraged by the tables she waits in a restaurant in Washington, D.C., and hears the lobbyists and the pharmaceuticals trying to convince doctors on what to prescribe and what to sell. So I definitely want to thank you for being an inspiration that, yes, I can make a change for this country. My question is regarding FARC and the release of Ingrid Betancourt. If these revolutionary groups do not have the tools to get into the media and be able to tell, in this case, Colombia, the truth about our government, what kind of tools can they use besides kidnapping and trying to get attention to them to be able to get to the people and, you know, we vote and we blindly vote and we keep having precedents that, as you said, Colombia is a keystone for North America to be able to get to the South American countries. And unfortunately, we keep having these corrupt precedents. What yeah. tools can they use?
Thank you. Tú eres de Colombia? ¿De qué parte? Mucho gusto. Yeah, Colombia and FARC. You know, you're too young, but I used to live in Colombia. I spent a lot of time in Barranquilla, and I had a little coffee farm up in the Sierra Nevada mountains where the Kogi live. This is in the 70s when I was an economic hitman. And at that time, FARC, I thought, was a legitimate organization because it was composed primarily of people that were opposing a hydroelectric plant that I was deeply involved in buying in financing and constructing on the Sinu River, the Alto Sinu and the Sinu rivers. And it was destroying tremendous amounts of campesino lands. And here was going to be this big hydroelectric project with these huge transmission lines that went over everybody's head and nobody got to benefit from it. All the electricity went into the big cities. And so FARC was formed for that and also because of the oil companies, what they were beginning to do out in the jungle areas. And these were desperate people whose land had been taken away from them. And in those days, they got a lot of financing from Russia and some from China. And so they were able to move forward. And, of course, we objected strongly to them as being communist organizations. But I knew FARC people, and they were desperate people. I've known a lot of terrorists, and I've never met a terrorist who wanted to be a terrorist. They all want to be with their families. They all want to be back on their land. But their lands have been destroyed, taken away from them. They don't know what to do. Same with the FARC people in those years. And then the Soviet Union and China went away. Détente, we think of as a good thing, but for the third world, there was a lot of aspects of détente that was a very bad thing because the Soviet Union was a balance to us. And when we got to be too oppressive, like with FARC, they could turn to the Soviet Union. And then the United States would usually moderate its attitude somewhat. And I'm glad there was détente on one level, but on another level, there's been no counterbalance. And so FARC then turned to extortion and drugs. And then that became a way of life. And they moved into that more and more. Raul Reyes, second in command of FARC, sent me an email a month before he was killed in Ecuador. When the Colombian Uribe sent the forces over into Ecuador and killed 20-some-odd, and Raul Reyes was in charge of them. He sent me an email, I have it at home, a month before, praising me for Confessions of an Economic Hitman, saying it gave the true story, and saying, I'm on my way to Ecuador now to try to broker a peace deal. Uribe, as you know, doesn't want a peace deal. He receives more money for military than any other country in Latin America. In fact, it's the fourth largest military recipient in the world after Iraq, Israel, and Egypt. Thank you. Colombia, fourth largest recipient. President of Colombia is one of the few holdouts in Latin America in this progressive movement. The only holdout of a really major, well, Peru also somewhat. But your question, how does FARC get heard? I don't know in this world now. We can make them heard. You can make them heard. Did you say you're a waitress?
Yes.
And what was the industry you wanted to reform?
Healthcare.
Healthcare system. And it sounds like you got another thing here, too. You know, corner some of those lobbyists. Corner some of those politicians. Or write something up. Get them, you know, let them. We've got to understand this terrible, terrible media presentation in this country that paints organizations like FARC as evil. And FARC today I'm very conflicted here because FARC is extorting people, it's kidnapping people, it's doing some pretty terrible things. There's a real question whether Betancourt was actually freed or whether there was a deal for $20 million struck, which I think there probably was, that was a put-up job. But we get this terrible misinformation. I pick up the newspaper and I read about that dictator, Hugo Chavez. You know, there's a lot of things about Hugo Chavez that bother me in terms of his personality, but he's not a dictator. He's elected by a much greater percentage of his population than our president is. So that's very much misinformation, and we must be careful. So work on really correcting that. And I have tremendous sympathy for those campesinos all over the world that can't be heard. We don't listen to them. We don't hear them. We don't even hear what Lynn described, what's going on in Ecuador. Rafael Correa has done an amazing thing. He's a legitimate president, this new constitution. And who hears about it in this country? Maybe people in this room have, but most of the world doesn't. And it's some of the most important news out there. So thank you. You spread the word. I mean, you're in a position to do that. You speak two languages. You know the Colombians. You know South America. You're eloquent in English. This is your time. tu tiempo ahora. Siga luchando. Viva la revolución. We are in a revolution. And all right, I'm closing now. So that was a great, yeah. So we are in a revolution. We truly are. And it's a peaceful revolution. It's a marketing revolution. It's an economic revolution. It's a revolution that you're an integral part of, whether you want to be or not. You can kind of sit on the sidelines, or you can actively, consciously wake up. Wakening the Dreamer, the program of Pachamama Alliance, is a great place to kind of get acquainted with this. And this is a time when I think we are awakening. And it's also the time prophesied by the Mayas, the Quechua, the Tibetans, so many cultures around the world, that we have entered a time of tremendous opportunity for transformation. And I want to leave you with a final quote from Martin Luther King, Jr. It's tough to stand in front of an audience and try to quote Martin Luther King, Jr. He was so eloquent and so expressive. So I'll just read what he said, and it's, he said, "I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war that the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality. I refuse to believe that. I believe, rather, that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word. Unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word. I think that's why we've come together here tonight, for all of us to spread the unarmed truth and the unconditional love, to create a sustainable, just, and peaceful world for every living creature on this planet. And I really look forward to moving into this new world with you. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.